Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, with Sue Majeure. Welcome, Sue.
Why, it's good to be here.
And Gary, welcome back.
I'm happy to be here.
Great.
The weather's still nice and still things do outside.
And we've got a quiz coming up, and we'll see how Tom and Sue do for Gary's quiz. We're in the October edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
I will. Heavenly Father, thank you for this beautiful weather that you have bestowed upon us at the end of the season. And there are still things growing and still things that you have created that we need to learn about that will let us show a light on your character so that we can learn and grow to know you better and go home with you forever. So thank you for what you have made. And bless us as we continue to learn. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, we're pretty excited about the quiz today. The topic is vanilla. Now, Gary gives us questions, but he doesn't provide the answers, at least until we're on air.
Before we started, Sue said she had read a book on vanilla, so she's ready to go.
Well, you know, I've always been intrigued about vanilla also. And when I was on a mission trip in Mexico, I saw vanilla growing on the plant. So I was most amazed about one thing is how come vanilla ice cream is white when the pods and the beans are brown?
Well, a lot of vanilla now, unless it says pure vanilla, is an artificial vanilla.
Even the real is artificial?
The artificial vanilla is clear.
Okay.
So, and when you buy something like Breyers and it'll say pure vanilla ice cream or whatever, you'll see little flecks,
yeah,
which are the seeds from the plant. But anyway. We'll get to that.
Oh, we'll get to that. Okay. Gary, why don't you start the quiz?
All right. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, what plant does vanilla come from?
Well, I get to answer first because I know less than my sister, so.
Yeah, this was designed to be an easy one so that we could make sure you had some confidence.
Well, good, because I always thought that Grant was buried in Grant's tomb, so I'm going to say vanilla.
Vanilla what?
Vanilla plant. I don't know. Vanilla bush. I give up. Sue, help me out.
Come on. Tell him, Sue.
It's an orchid vine.
It's an orchid. That's right. And there are between 20 to 30,000 species of orchids in the world. And depending on what reference, because I went to DuckDuckGo, it said about 28,000. On Google, it said about 30,000. So I'm not sure they've settled on how many there actually are.
Let's take an average of 29.
Yeah, that's fine. But anyway, they're among one of the largest groups of flowering plants, along with the aster family. So that's a lot of species.
That's really interesting because in the northern climes, do we have less orchids than the rest of the world?
Well,
maybe
they're
in the tropics, but
yeah,
there's still orchids here.
Yeah, we have orchids, but we bring them in. I mean, orchids require a specific condition, and we're going to talk about growing an orchid plant that will produce vanilla, and we'll get to that in a little bit.
But just the point is they aren't native to these
climes.
No. Okay.
It's too cold in most of the United States. The next question is, how many orchid, I guess, species can actually produce the vanilla?
One.
Actually, there are over 110 different species that are in the genera, like the genus, and a genus is one step up above species. So, for instance, when we're talking about the genus Prunus, we're talking about cherries and apricots and peaches. They're very similar. So, in that genus, which, by the way, the genus is called Vanilla.
Oh, okay, good.
There are about 110 plants that you can collect the seeds from that would give you the flavor. But there's one specific plant, it's called Vanilla plantifolia, that has the highest levels of that material, vanillin, and that's where they get most of it from.
So let me ask you this question. You know, for maple syrup, you can make syrup, table syrup, from a number of things. You can even make it from beech and others, but the sugar content is much lower. Is that similar to the vanilla? Is that, you said there's 100 in that class.
Yeah.
But you'll get a higher productivity from the one.
Look at it this way. When you eat apples,
okay, yeah.
For instance, if you ate, say, a Red Delicious or a Golden Delicious and they were ripe, they would be much sweeter than, say, a Cortland. So there's variation in the sweetness within various types of fruits. So it's the same thing with vanilla. And that brings up one other thing. Now, we know that Vanilla plantifolia is the number one place to get the vanilla from. But where is the best place to grow vanilla on the planet? Where do you think that would be?
Tom, do you know? Because this one I do know.
I was going to say Mexico because I saw it there. But other than that, I'll have to defer to Sue.
No, it's going to be the bourbon vanilla, as they refer to it. It was grown on the Ile Bourbon, it's Reunion now, and Madagascar.
Yeah,
in that area.
Madagascar is the place that the orchid grows so well that it produces the highest levels of vanillin. And so, and we're going to talk more about how they make extract and flavoring and all that in a few minutes. So we already answered this one. The flavor from the vanilla comes from what part of the plant?
It comes from the beans.
More specifically.
The little seeds in the inside when you scrape it.
Yeah.
And it has like the seeds and the kind of a goo.
Yeah, that's where you get the real flavor from. So the pod itself isn't usually used, but it's the seeds that you really want to get. And that's those little flecks I told you when you look at, say, Breyer's Pure Vanilla Ice Cream.
Aren't vanilla beans, it's been 15 years, but don't they look like peas in a pod? I mean, aren't they about
No, they're very small.
Okay.
Yeah, like little flecks, like... Thistle seed are smaller
than poppy seeds. If you've ever seen poppy seeds on bread,
sure,
they're really tiny.
Okay.
The other thing, you should get this one. Nearly 80% of the world's vanilla supply is grown in what country?
Madagascar. I don't know.
Yeah, Madagascar. Yeah. That's where you get the most flavorful vanilla, it would seem that you'd get the best growth there, and that's where most of it would come from. Now, what's the difference between artificial vanilla and the real stuff? So I'm asking you, what is artificial vanilla here?
Well, artificial vanilla, they make it from like wood and tree bark.
Yeah, it's synthetically produced, but this is really weird. One of the ways they make it is from eugenol and something called guaiacol, which are derivatives from petrochemicals, in other words, crude oil. You'd be surprised what we get from crude oil.
Oh.
Anyway, and a small amount of synthetic vanillin is produced from lignin waste. And lignin is the material that gives plant cells their strength. And so it's a byproduct of the wood pulp industry. So, but now people would go, that sounds terrible. And it does, but because most people like natural stuff. But it has a very strong flavor. And if it's baked, like when you're making baked goods or you're mixing with other ingredients, like when you're making a cake, you really can't tell the difference. You can tell the difference if it's used in fresh things like frostings and whipped cream and that type of thing. If you have good taste buds, which I have really good taste buds, so I'd be able to tell the difference. So the next one I want to ask you is, what's the difference between vanilla extract and vanilla flavoring?
Well, the extract is made in alcohol. It's like soaked in there.
Right. They say steeped in alcohol. And when you said when you said bourbon, people will use vodka, bourbon, but what you need is just ethyl alcohol. And that's the kind that people drink. And they burn it too. If you've ever had a chemistry class, you probably burn ethyl alcohol. And for people who don't drink alcohol, when you're using it to bake or something like that, the alcohol is driven off. It breaks down. If you were using vanilla extract in a fresh frosting, then you will have some alcohol in there. So, and to be alcohol extract, it shouldn't have more than 35% alcohol, and it has to have a certain amount of vanilla beans in it. To be a true extract.
So what is the flavoring?
The flavoring is a little different. It's steeped in water.
Okay.
So if somebody wants to avoid alcohol altogether, then vanilla flavoring is the way to go.
What is the flavor results between you compare?
They're comparable. They're comparable. So because they do have laws as to what has to be in it. And if it's pure vanilla, then it only has two ingredients, the carrier, which would be either the water or the alcohol, and the vanilla beans. Now, there's another one called vanilla paste. Have you ever heard of that?
Vaguely, yeah.
And you know what vanilla paste is, Sue?
It's the scraping from the inside of the pod.
Mm-hmm. And what else?
And the seeds.
Yeah, but there's something that makes it a paste.
What's the substrate?
Well, I guess on the substrate. I don't remember what the goo is comprised of.
Yeah,
it was a while since I read the book. But
they'll use what they call a natural thickener, which would be glycerin, which you can get from plants. And that gives it that consistency. In some cases, the paste may contain some sugar, some added sugar. But the paste is used in certain things. Like if you want a real bold vanilla taste, then people will use the paste. And so it's a little different. I've tried both. I haven't noticed that much of a difference, although I think it's a little stronger in the paste form. But you want to be sure that you get pure vanilla extract. Now, some people out there might know about the concern of vanilla having what I like to call beaver butt juice, if you've ever heard of that. It's a secretion from a gland that's near the anal glands on a beaver. And it's said to have kind of like a vanilla smell to it. But you don't really have to worry about that, because most of the vanilla that people are using nowadays is imitation anyway. And also it's an okay food additive, but very, very, very few people are using it now. I think part of the reason is because people have been finding out that it's been used in the past, and maybe we're just running out of beavers. I don't know. I think that's a terrible thing to do to beavers, but you never know. That's why you need to read those labels.
And when people found out what cochineal was really from.
Yeah, from beetles, crushed up beetles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for the red coloring. But the other thing is when it says something like natural flavoring added to something, then you might be a little concerned about whether it's in there or not, because they don't tell you what the natural flavorings are. So the next thing I want to talk about is, can you grow your own vanilla plant?
Well, if the farmers can do it, the producers, you should be able to do it too.
It's very labor intensive, though, per se.
Yeah, it is. And we're going to go over that a little bit here. First of all, if you want to buy a vanilla orchid, you can just go on Google and type in what you want. You can either type in vanilla orchid or where to buy and put the scientific name in there, and lots of options will come up. You can get them on Etsy. You can even buy them on Amazon. And so there's some pointers I want to give you if you want to try this, but I would only try it if you're one of these people that like a challenge. and we'll go over the reasons why. First, you want to start out with a terracotta pot. You want to avoid plastic because plastic doesn't breathe. And if you tend to be a little bit on the heavy watering side, the plant can die from root rot. And that pot should be at least 12 inches across so that the roots have plenty of space to grow. Now, the substrate, and I say substrate instead of soil, is because many times we'll use like a cocoa chip orchid medium or orchid potting mix, and they have different types, because when you think about how orchids grow, they grow up along things like trees, and they're epiphytes in that they gain some of their water and nutrients from whatever they're growing on. So, and they like to have good drainage, so orchid soils drain the water away pretty quickly. They do need support also, so you want to use a non-rotting wood as a support, like cedar or cypress, and it should be at least 3 to 4 feet tall, because you're going to want to train your vine to go up that support. And as it grows, you will start to get offshoots, especially toward the top. And it's okay to let it flop over once it gets up to the top of your trellis or your support, because that actually can help the plant to flower. And you will have to tie your vine to the support. And in terms of light, they like good quality light. They like bright light, but they don't like to be outside in the noonday sun. Remember, they're kind of understory plants. So light down near the equator and in the tropical areas will be quite bright compared to when you're getting it at an angle. So you want to make sure you can do that. They will do okay in partial sun, but they won't do well in deep shade. They just won't grow as fast. Also, they prefer higher temperatures between 70 and 90 degrees. If it drops below 60, they slow down their growth, and getting them to grow fast is everything, because they're going to need to be at least 3 to 5 feet before you even have a chance of getting a flower. And then in terms of fertility, they don't like concentrated fertilizer, so using an organic balanced fertilizer like a 7-9-5 or something similar. Balance means that you have relatively the same amounts of each of the top three nutrients, and they should be, it's most likely it's going to be a liquid, and you're going to fertilize about every other watering, because you don't have soil there to hold nutrients. You have the substrate, which is basically wood. And then especially during the summer months, you want to do this fertilizing, every other watering. And then the other thing you want to be sure of is there's a product called Orchid Mist, M-Y-S-T, that you'll want to get. And I think we're out of time, so we're going to have to come back.
So stay tuned. You'll learn if you want to grow a vanilla orchid or not. Your host is Tom Majeure with Sue Majeure, and Gary Heilig will be back soon.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with The Garden Guy. I'm Tom Majeure with Sue Majeure on Strong Tower Radio. Gary, where did we leave off with vanilla?
Well, we're talking about fertilization if you're going to try to grow the vine, and I was mentioning a product called Orchid Mist, spelled M-Y-S-T, and it has micronutrients in it, and it's used to enhance the growth of the vine and also to keep it flowering longer. And in Michigan, you're going to want every advantage you can get. So that's something you might want to try. And Sue, you were telling me during the break about something about orchid rustling.
Yes, it's there are so many bizarre things behind one of our favorite spices. In Madagascar and Reunion, there were, you know, the best bourbon vanilla is grown. they've had wild fluctuations, like in the last century, in the prices, like because there was a hurricane and flooding or whatever that devastated the plantations. So the price went from like $20 a pound to $500 and a lot of stuff. So it became very, very valuable. And it's so hand intensive, you know, such handwork. So it's expensive to grow. And it's way out in the boonies. So what happened is people were actually stealing the beans. There was vanilla rustling. So to try to combat some of that, they would actually stamp on the pods themselves like a brand, because it would stay there all through the growth and it couldn't be taken off. So they were, it sounds like cattle ranching, but they were actually branding their pods to keep them from being rustled. And this still goes on today because it's such a lucrative thing if there's a successive crop. But there's not a lot of banks or anything out there in the boonies. So when the vanilla bean pod brokers come to bargain for the crop, they actually go out right out in the boonies with cars filled with cash, all kinds, a huge, amazing amounts of cash, and armed guards with like automatic weapons.
Oh, man.
So that they won't be robbed. So they go out there, look over, bargain for the thing, and they pay cash in the barrelhead, because if you live out in the boonies on the mountain, you're not going to stroll hundreds of miles to the nearest bank.
Yeah.
So that's all they'll accept. And so there's been murders and robberies and everything over vanilla beans to actually get them to the drying sheds so they can be taken and then ready for market and then processed. I mean, it's things you never heard of. The next time you have some vanilla ice cream or a vanilla cookie.
There's a war going on out there, yeah. But I'm not surprised. I mean, this is the kind of world we live in right now. So anyway, if you want to get the plant to flower, as I mentioned earlier, when it reaches about 3 to 5 feet, it'll be mature enough to flower. And as I also mentioned, allow it to droop over your support, which will encourage flowering. What initiates flowering is somewhat variable, and the experts think that a dry period for a couple of months in the winter, as well as the vine reaching the top of the support and cascading over, tends to stimulate the flowering process. Now, when I worked at Michigan State in the teaching greenhouses, we had a vine growing along the inner walls, and it was like 8 to 10 feet long, and it never bloomed for many years. I think we did get 1 year that it started to bloom. So doing these things that we were talking about will help to speed that process up, even though it was in a greenhouse, which is pretty much ideal for it. Now, when the flowers do come out, they have to be hand-pollinated, and you only have 1 day to get it done.
Mm.
So if you miss it, you just miss it.
So does all of the plants all have to be done on that day?
Whenever those new flowers come out, you have to watch your plant. And new flowers come out, you pollinate it, and you use a toothpick to do that. Now, what I would also suggest you do is orchids are a little different than most flowers. So you might want to go online and look up the anatomy of an orchid so that you'll know how to pollinate. They're a little different than most flowers. So anyway, once you've pollinated it, you will have to wait 9 months in order to get a mature pod, which will be about 5 inches long. And you don't harvest it until the tips start to turn yellow. And if you harvest too soon, that will reduce the vanillin content in it, so it won't ever develop the full flavor that you're looking for. Then after that, you have to go through a curing process. And also, the curing process helps you to get that desired aroma and flavor from your vanilla beans. And the thing that you have to remember, it's a process that takes a few months. So it takes 4 to 6 months to go through this drying process.
That's after 9 months of growth.
Yeah. So now you see why I said if you wanted to have a challenge, because if you're one of these people that likes to plant zinnias, get your flowers and be done with it, this is not the project for you.
It's not radishes.
No. And then, of course, after that, if you want to make your own vanilla extract, you need to have about 6 to 8 pods and the seeds from inside those pods to about 25 ounces of your carrier, whether it's water or alcohol. And so you can store this at room temperature in a dark place, like in the back of the cabinet or someplace. And you want it away from heat sources, so you don't want it in the cabinet right next to your stove. And it will start to be ready in about another 2 months. But the longer it steeps, you'll get a stronger flavor. And also, you have to do some shaking. So the first week, you do some shaking, and then after time passes, like that couple of months, you can shake it once or twice a week. But then it'll turn a rich brown, and it'll start to be usable when you get that fragrance that you would get from a bottle of vanilla from the store. And it can last quite a while. So it's a project. It's certainly a project. But orchids are nice, too, because even though the flower may not be pollinated, lots of orchid flowers will last more than a day. It's just that your option to pollinate is only a day.
Wow.
And you can reuse the pods. If you're making something that requires you to split the vanilla pod, yeah, and then scrape it out and use the flavoring, take the pod and put it in a little jar of sugar. Shake it occasionally and keep it in there, and you'll have vanilla sugar.
Yeah, you can use the pods more than once to make your vanilla product. So now, I'm going to be 70 years old in December, but I'm going to buy a vanilla orchid. I just want to try it. When I do the research for these different things and I find out all this stuff, I was kind of downtrodden when I found out it took so long, but I think I'll live a few more years, so I would like to give that a shot. So maybe in the future we'll talk about whether it works or not.
I got some. We've got some questions about our garden coming up here, but
go right ahead. Anytime you're ready.
When I walked home at noon, I noticed the grasshoppers seemed to be very, very prolific. Give us a grasshopper report.
I've seen grasshoppers around, but they're not that bad. I mean, most of the stuff they're chewing on, you're not going to be bothered with anyway, because we're toward the end of our gardening season. But just as a side note, did you know that we used to have locusts in the United States?
Oh, big time.
So yeah. What happened to them?
Well, they didn't try to eradicate them. It's just that through the farming system that we have here, they kind of died out. So we don't have the locust plagues that you see in Africa and other places. But we did have a North American locust at one time. But the grasshoppers that we have, they'll feed on some things, but leaves are going to be falling pretty soon. The garden's pretty much finished. The flowers don't look that good anyway. So if a grasshopper starts chewing on something, I don't get concerned about it at all. When I let my dogs out yesterday, there was a grasshopper inside the screen door. And I said, how did you get in here? And so I just told him, you don't have much time. You better get out there and do your living, because when it gets cold, you're done. Usually after they mate, they die pretty quickly.
Wow. There's little grasshoppers and big ones, but that's a whole different subject.
Well, they're different species out there. So.
Yeah. What else should we be looking at this month?
Well, as you said, we're getting to the end of season, and I walked out in my garden, and like most people, after a certain point, you kind of don't weed as much. And so I let the weeds get a little tall, and some of them have seeds on it. So I said, all right, what am I going to do about this? Because when you allow the weeds to produce, one plant will produce thousands of seeds, and those seeds can last decades in the soil. So if you're in the right place, like out in the country, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy some straw. I'll cut down all the weeds first and burn as many of them as I can, because I'm burning stuff after that big storm in September. I don't know if we talked about that or not, but boy, did I get a whooping on that
oh,
one.
Oh, boy. defoliated some of your trees?
Trees snapped in half, stuff falling down all over the yard. But anyway, so I'll burn the big weeds, and then all those seeds that will fall off into the ground, I'm going to spread straw over the surface of the ground. And then I'll just set it on fire. And, of course, you don't want it too thick, because then you can get a fire that will get out of control. But you want it just thick enough so that it will get real hot under there, and all those weeds on the surface will be burned up, and that'll take care of most of that. Now, if you're in the city, that's probably not going to work too well. You need to be careful, especially if you're around dry grasses. Fires can get out of control, and usually the way that works, if the fire department has to come out and you start a wildfire, guess who's going to pay everything?
You are.
You are. So you want to be careful about that. And, of course, be sure that you check what the weather is going to be before you do something like that.
Does that work on Johnson grass? I know Tom and Brenda have been fighting that for like the last 2 years.
Well, any perennial grass, it can handle fire going over it. So the roots will be insulated from the heat. If it was very small plant, then the heat from the fire could kill it before the root system got established. But once it's an established plant, you're not going to kill off grass. Because one, I had a big miscanthus grass, which was about 6 to 7 feet tall. And what I did for fun was I just waited for it to dry off and I'd set it on fire. And it burned really quickly and burned right down to the ground, and it would come back next year. So, no, fire won't take care of mature grasses.
Well, let's talk a little bit about garden cleanup.
Well, we're getting to that time. We were looking at our tomatoes the other day, and we just finished making some tomato soup this morning, and we're at the point where we're going to start to dig up plants. Now, there are a couple of things you can do. You can let things dry out, pile them up, burn them, put them in a compost pile. And some people will say, well, don't put, you know, disease stuff in a compost pile. But if you build a hot pile, you can eliminate a lot of those weed seeds and disease fungi.
When you say hot, that means that...
A hot pile is one that has the proper ratio of high nitrogen to high carbon materials. So you want twice as much carbon as high nitrogen material, or you can just use a nitrogen fertilizer with your high carbon materials. And it's moist, so it's well wet down. Now, some people will tell you, don't soak it down, but we did years of observational research over at an arboretum when we ran the master composter class for many years, and we soaked it down, and it turned out better than if you... They say wet it until the water won't run out of your hand. Well, things dry out pretty quickly in Michigan in the fall because we still have warm weather. So we would soak them down, and we would get temperatures up to close 150 degrees in the middle of the pile. And so getting the right carbon and nitrogen ratio, right amount of moisture, and also making sure your pile is a minimum of 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, because it has to insulate in order to build up that level of heat, and it'll heat up. Now, when it's that hot, what I told people was, once it gets below 100 degrees, which means you're going to need a composting thermometer, then you flip your pile and turn the stuff that's on the outside to the middle. And that way, once that stuff breaks down, you can use it in the garden. And if, say, for instance, you're still concerned about it, put the compost away from, say, your plants that had disease the previous year, like your tomatoes. Don't put it on the tomatoes. You could use it around flowers or whatever. So you want to have a hot pile. One other thing that I did, every now and then I would dig a hole in the garden, and it might be 3 feet by 3 feet and maybe 3 feet deep, depending on how much stuff you have to bury. And I would just bury all of that stuff right there. And of course the worms would eat it, and it would add a lot of organic matter to that spot. And when you would put a plant over that the next year, it would just grow like gangbusters because it had all that organic matter that the earthworms had processed. And then of course, once you've done that, if you have a rototiller, you can till your garden under. And what that does is, if you have, say, squash vine borers, which they like to overwinter in the soil, if they're moved down deeper or they're exposed, then predators will get them, or they'll die due to the cold weather. And if you still have areas that you're growing things like squash or late watermelon or something like that. Just clean out the areas that you can clean out and get a head start on things. And that way, when spring comes, you're more ready. It's not too late to put a cover crop down. October is getting late, but annual rye will grow anytime the temperatures are above 40 degrees. So if you get in a cover crop early in October, you'll get sufficient growth before it stops growing. And that will help to keep weeds down also.
One thing.
I have a question about their kind of the end of the year, because the produce is winding down, as you say. But I got some heirloom pumpkin seeds for Brenda, and Tom sprouted them, and he dutifully planted them, and he nourished them when they were sickly, and they grew. And one variety was Blue Jarredale, and the other variety was Silver Edged. Now, he planted some of both, but this is the strange thing. There's a number of the Blue Jarredales, but only one silver-edged pumpkin.
Okay.
That they can pick. So why is that?
Well, one of the things that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because if you have something that's a heritage variety or what we call open pollinated, you can collect those seeds and they'll normally grow true to form. Now, squash can cross, and if they were closely related, they can cross. Now, why you got the blue ones more than the other ones, maybe you just had better seed collected from the other one, because you really have to make sure that you collect fully mature seeds. And if you collect seeds that aren't fully mature, then they're not going to germinate well the next year. But without spending a little bit more time talking to you off air, I'm not positive as to what it might be. There's a couple of possibilities.
Very good. Well, we're completing our second segment. We've got more in the next, so stay tuned. We'll be right back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy on Strong Tower Radio.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy on Strong Tower Radio. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, with Sue Majeure, and we're talking about cleaning up our garden. What else do we need to talk about?
Well, in terms of cleaning up the garden?
Yes.
Well, for instance, in my garden, I also have raspberry plants, and they're everbearers, and they're finishing up right now. And I have the option of cutting them all the way back, in which I'll probably do that. That way I won't have anything until next year. But if you've had regular raspberries like Latham, for instance, that's a cultivar, the ones that produced fruit this year will not produce any more fruit on that cane. So you can take those canes out right to the ground at any time. So a lot of times people have a lot of stuff to do in the spring, and they, because they're getting new plants in, they're planting and all these sorts of things, tilling the garden, fertilizing. And so whatever you can push into the fall, even though most people want to quit at that time, it's a good thing to do that. So that's one of the things you could do is prune the raspberries. Make sure all the weeds are out of the strawberries. They're not going to be covered until about November. They may still be producing, but if you are growing Everbear strawberries. They'll continue to produce until it gets too cold to produce. And if you want to avoid having those fruit flies that I told you about, the spotted winged Drosophila, you'll have to continue to treat. Otherwise, you will have worms in those berries. And what we normally do is after we till our garden, then we'll put black plastic over it. And if the garden's not too big, that'll keep the weeds from growing next spring. And the soil will be nice and bare. Any perennial weeds that were growing, they would have all died out. So right now, perennial weeds are producing sugars and shipping them down to their root to survive the winter. You cover them up with black plastic, they're not going to be there in the spring. And it doesn't matter what the weed is. They just won't be able to make it because they weren't able to store up the sugars because they're covered with black plastic. It won't work with clear, though. They'll actually grow very well under there.
What about what's the last things that are left in our gardens? We have squash and what?
People may still have onions in their garden. They may still have potatoes in the garden to dig up. Certainly there'll be various herbs that are still producing. Like we just harvested the last of our basil, for instance, and my wife was making, what do you call that stuff?
Pesto.
Pesto, yeah. Senior moment.
Oh, isn't that good stuff, that pesto?
Oh, yeah. Mm. And I like to make a homemade pizza and then put fresh basil on it. It's just unbelievable.
Oh, that's so yummy.
We have to talk about pizza sometime.
All right.
It took me 15 years to perfect pizza, and I won't go into all the details
now. We could talk about basil. There's lemon basil and Italian basil and whole.
Yeah, well,
Thai basil.
Yeah, I like the Italian on my pizza, although Thai basil is great with Asian dishes. But also, there may be some beans that are still producing that you can continue to harvest.
Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, Brussels sprouts will be ready. If you have various greens like collards, a light frost will improve the flavor of those, but a hard frost will ruin the flavor. So make sure you start watching the weather pretty closely.
And popcorn?
Pardon? Popcorn? Popcorn I would leave on there as long as possible. Let it dry on the stalk. And if it looks like it's going to be a lot of rain, then you might want to take it off and finish drying it in the house, because it has to be dried down to about 3% moisture level in order for it to pop well. And I had some sweet corn one year that it wasn't all picked and there were kernels on the ground. And I did one of those burns and I had popcorn popping all over the garden. It was really interesting. It wasn't popping as fluffy as the popcorn because it was sweet corn, but it still popped.
We harvested Brussels sprouts deep into the winter and even kale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is this in your greenhouse or in the garden?
In the garden.
Yeah.
Open garden.
I would think that the kale might have a little off flavor. Was it okay?
We didn't notice the difference.
Hey, if it's worked for you, do it.
And it was fresh. It's amazing how cold it went down to. Let's talk about picking apples, the late apples.
Yeah, the best apples are the later apples. For instance, people are going to be picking empires. And also, there's a late pear that we don't grow here very often. It's the one that you get in the gift packs. I'm forgetting the name of it right now. But
the Camas?
Camas. Camas. Thank you very much, Sue. But anyway, Camas has to stay on the tree as long as possible because it's a very late pear. I have a Camas tree, but it's not producing yet. And so most of our Camas pears come from Washington in that area of the country. But I want to see if I can grow them here because it's like the Cadillac of pears. Very fine grain, very sweet. But if you happen to be trying one of those, you have to wait for that one before you can harvest it.
And I haven't been able to try those, although I confess to a passion for ripe seckel pears. Oh,
well, if you have never tried a Camas?
I haven't tried the Camas. When I tried the seckel pears, when they're ripe, and they're so tiny, but when you're eating them and they're ripe,
they're very sweet.
They smell like roses under your nose.
Yeah, most people don't grow a lot of pears, but there's a lot of cool pears out there that people should try. Maybe I'll do a video on that sometime. But anyway, we were talking about apples. Most of the apples will be ready to go and toward the end of the season, about mid-October. And so the thing that I would suggest people do is taste them, because my wife tasted one a couple of days ago and she said it still tastes kind of starchy, and that was an Empire. So you need to let it stay on a little bit longer so that starch converts to sugar. And that's one of the best ways, is just taste it and see if it's, if you think it's ready. Another way you can do it is you can buy a refractometer, and the refractometer will tell you what the sugar levels are, and you can go online to find out what the sugar level should be for different fruits, whatever the fruit might be, and then you can pick it based on that too, depending on what you want to do. The longer you allow it to ripen, the sweeter the fruit will be, but the shorter the shelf life will be. So the quality will be high, but it's a very short period of time.
Is there a time when it gets just too cold and the apple becomes frozen and it's no
good? When you get temperatures around zero, but frost doesn't hurt apples at all. So
good northern crop.
And I didn't do much with my apples this year because I was doing other things, but we still have quite a few apples out there. I have to go out there.
You should taste the apple juice that Tom made last year. It wasn't sickly sweet like the commercial stuff you buy. It was like more like lightly sweet apple water. It was really, really good.
Well, all cider is not the same. Because and at the fruit show, the fruit and vegetable show in Grand Rapids every year, they have a cider contest. And so the different farmers will have their various mixes, because some of the tart apples have a little different flavor than the sweetest apples, and they'll mix them together to get that blend that they like. And some will actually put pears in their apple cider. So I would think that that would disqualify you. But anyway, I don't know if they let just ordinary people just try those different ones, but they're really good. And you can make specific ciders like just Gravenstein or just McIntosh or whatever the case may be. And it's kind of cool.
Let's talk about bringing our indoor plants from outdoors back in, and some of the risks and things that we need to handle.
Well, they're no dangerous risks, but when they come in, especially if something's been sitting on the porch or on the ground, you can get worms in your pot, and you can get the
mites.
Sow bugs. I'm talking about the soil right now.
Okay.
And also, you can bring in tree frogs. I've had tree frogs come out of various things. We have some fairly large plants, and they just like to hang out in there. And they don't do very well in the house, so I try to get them out back outside. Also, you can bring in some insects, aphids and spider mites, and earwigs. Sometimes you'll bring in a moth or two, and they could. There's a lot of things that like to live in those plants, so you really need to check them. It's the insects that are the real problem, and you may want to treat them before they come in. The ones I would worry about the most would be scale and aphids and mites, because once they get inside and they're in that warm weather with no predators, their populations can explode. With something like a sow bug or an earwig, I mean, there's only going to be so many of them, and then they're done. They're not going to reproduce in the house. Most of them won't survive very long as the humidity drops in the house during the winter months. But you do need to check, especially if you're bug averse.
There you go.
For me, I don't mind it. I just pick them up and throw them outside, and that's it.
What about have you ever had many flower pot snakes come in?
Flower pot snakes, did you say? I haven't yet. It's not impossible. But it would have to be a fairly low pot. And usually a snake would climb up into something. Like if it was a cool day and the pot was warm, then a cold-blooded creature would crawl in there. But I haven't had one yet.
I was thinking about those little ones. I've seen them like on a show where they're in, you know, in the greenhouse or something, and they turned it out, and they're I'm not sure if they're blind, maybe, but they're like they're just like a little tiny snake. They never get beyond 4 to 6 inches.
You might be talking about, was it a brown snake with kind of a patchwork on it?
I think so. Because
one of the smaller snakes is the milk snake, and you don't see it very often, but that might be one. And I do see small ones every now and then. But they will be, especially in the fall, they're going to be attracted to warm things because I always see snakes in my greenhouse, like snakes on a plane, snakes in a greenhouse. And I see those in the spring, and sometimes they'll be there in the summer. So it's possible, but not that likely, that a snake will climb up into a pot. They'll get into a low pot, but I wouldn't expect them to get into a high one.
Let's talk about treatment of those aphids and things that come into...
Well, one of the things you can use is insecticidal soaps, and they tend to desiccate soft-bodied insects, even though mites aren't truly insects, but it still will work on them. And the other one is horticultural oils. And what they do is they coat the creature, and it basically smothers them. So either one of those will work. It's better to do it while they're still outside. And you might want to treat them twice, maybe 2 weeks apart. And coverage is very important. And that will knock their numbers down quite low. And then I would just watch the plants after I take them in the house to see if their numbers are going to build up. The mites you'll find under the leaves, as well as most scales will be under the leaves, but you can also see them on top of the leaves.
You need to kind of spray from the up.
Yeah, you have to spray bottom and top. Everything in the case of scales, you want to make sure that trunks and limbs are wet also.
What about planting bulbs and such?
Yeah, September is the ideal time to plant bulbs, but a lot of times people will get them in a little bit later. Like my wife has some right now that need to be planted. And as we've said in the past, if you don't plant them, they're just continually using up the energy that they have until they just shrivel up to nothing. So even October, even into November, if you can work the soil, you want to get those bulbs in the ground. The reason we want to get them in September is because bulbs will start to grow and put out their root system and get established. So the later you plant them, the less they're going to get established, but they'll survive better than they will if you don't plant them.
Very good.
Of course, you can always put them in pots, too.
What else do we need to... what about pepper plants, two-year pepper plants?
The reason I put that in there is pepper plants are perennial plants where they grow naturally. So one of the things I'm going to do this year is I'm going to dig up one of my jalapeno plants, and then I will put it in a pot. Of course, I'll treat it for any possible pests that are on there. And then I'll grow it indoors. And then next year, I'll take it back outside. It'll get much larger, and it'll get to the size to where all you'll need is one jalapeno plant. So it's just something fun to do. But a lot of times people think that many things are annuals when actually they might be biennials or perennials in their native area.
Very good. What last-minute thoughts do we have for our listeners?
Well, one of the things that you should do is evaluate how things worked out, especially if you try new varieties and things, and make sure that you write yourself a note as to what you want to start buying. And it's not too early to buy seeds for next year. Make sure that all your seeds are stored in a cool, dry place in a container that won't be susceptible to rodents. I prefer to keep mine in the basement, but you can, if you don't have a lot of seeds, you can keep them in the bottom of the refrigerator, and they'll last just fine.
Very good. Any weed control lawn work we need to do? Of course, the leaves are falling. And
October is a great time to get rid of something like Creeping Charlie. It's a good time to get rid of a lot of the broadleaf weeds. Just pick a day that's sunny, and don't spray if you've just mowed. You want to wait at least 2 or 3 days and then treat. And after you've applied it, it helps to get some rain because the plants will be shipping material down to the root system, and that will help to get them, cause them to die. The last thing I wanted to mention is we had that big storm here in Michigan in September, and I had a guy come to my front porch. And he was asking if I wanted an estimate to have all those trees done, but I told him I was going to do it myself because I know it's going to be thousands of dollars. And so I said, no, but thanks. But I took his card. And if you're going to have somebody help you with something like that, be sure they're licensed, insured, and bonded. And that way, you're covered in the event that they get hurt on your property.
Mm. Good point.
Why is this time of year the best time to build raised beds?
Because things are winding down, and you don't have to worry about doing it in the spring, because in the spring you want to plant. You don't want to be building raised beds. So do as much in the fall as you can. It's nothing more than that.
And what you always say is sharpen your lawn mower, change the oil, and do some of that work before spring.
Get those things done before spring, because there's so much to do in spring, and you're trying to mow the grass, you're trying to prune the trees, you're trying to plant the flowers, you're trying to till the garden. And as much as you can do in the fall, it makes the job more fun in the spring, and not so much drudgery, depending on how much stuff you're growing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Gary. It's each month, and the cumulative experience, we have this on our website, strongtowerradio.org, or just to make it easy, a link at str.fm. And there is a page under archives for good growing for the garden guy. If it's you're in a particular month, you might want to look back over a couple years of programs and glean things from past programs. For Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, I'm Tom Majeure, and until next time, good growing. Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to Strong Tower Radio Network. Our stations reach from Kalamazoo over to Lansing and up to the Mackinac Bridge, and then west to Ironwood on the border of Wisconsin, and even a station in central Illinois. Our most southerly station is 97.3 W247 AM Kalamazoo. Driving north on 131, you can tune to 91.9 WMJC in Richland. Continuing north on 131, you can tune to 89.7 WNHG Grand Rapids. Driving west from Grand Rapids, you can tune to 93.1 WMPA Ferrisburg. Driving north from Grand Rapids, you can continue to listen to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 91.9 FM WGCP Cadillac. Driving east from Grand Rapids to Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 1540 AM KTGG Okemos and 104.7 W284 AH Lansing, as well as 92.3 W222 CU Charlotte. Driving north from Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 90.7 FM WBHL Harrison. Continuing your drive north, you can keep listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 93.9 FM WAVC Mayo and 102.7 FM W274BN Alpena. Crossing over the beautiful Mackinac Bridge, you can hear Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 97.9 WIHC Newberry. Driving west of Newberry, Strong Tower Radio can be received by tuning to WUPJ Escanaba on 90.9 FM. Driving further west, tune to 91.3 FM W217CG Ironwood. And lastly, in the heart of the land of Lincoln, tune to Strong Tower Radio on 91.3 FM W217BB Hickory Point. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.